Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. On today's episode of Wandering DMs, if we don't have any more technical glitches, the half dozen we've had so far, we're going to be talking about economic systems and trading in D&D and becoming a capitalist, corporatist king. And whether or not your players actually want that, which maybe they don't. Today on Wandering DMs.
Yeah, sorry about the little hiccup right there. That was that one was my fault. Actually, I want to point out to everyone, remind everyone that we are running a fundraiser for the Bell Project. We're in our final days of it. It's going to end with the end of June. I'm just going to post the link here in the chat if anybody cares to donate. We recently got a donation from an anonymous fan of Disinvited guest Isabel Garbani. So thank you so much for that. I posted the link in the chat, and that's totally the reason why we had that little hitch there, just because I was trying to dig up that link and get it ready to post. Yeah. And funny story, exactly what was happening to me on Thursday in 10 Dead Rats. I was hearing the show echo back at me. And the reason for that is when I open that very link on my browser, of course, the stream starts.
Oh, right.
Then right. I realize, oh, I'm listening to the stream and streaming at the same time. It's a bad idea. Don't do that.
You know, at least half the times when we had audio problems, that's the cause, is that we've accidentally had the show open in some other browser or interface or something like that.
It's easy to lose it in another tab of your browser and then not realize, like, where's that audio coming from? Oh,
that totally has happened to me before. Yeah. Yeah. I got to say, thanks to Isabel for promoting our fundraiser, actually. So yesterday was her birthday, and I asked
Happy birthday,
her what, I asked her what she, well, I wish you she could hear you in person, but she's disinvited. I asked her what she wanted for her birthday, and very, generously, and that's what she's like. She says, I want people to generate to the Bail Project, actually. So I did actually not on our fundraiser specifically, and she posted on social media to any of her friends that wanted to give her something to do that, actually. So big thanks for the help to Isabel on that.
Thank you so much.
And anybody that donates during our show, that'll show up instantly on the tab up above as long as we're live. So we would certainly appreciate that.
Yep. So glad to hear that it wasn't her birthday wish to have no internet, because that's the other road bump we very nearly crashed head first into. I was all set to have an audio only Dan today on the phone.
Yeah, I had a long internet outage. I mean, oddly, and the thing that was actually really confusing is we successfully, thank you, Ash, for the wishes there. We successfully ran the war game last night, and then immediately afterwards, our internet here cut out for half a day, apparently. So the other, I will say that the second wish that she had was to crush me in the war game Saturday night, and she got that too. She actually, that was great. The worst pasting that I've taken in an episode so far is I did let her, she said, I would like to be able to use some of the monsters or exotic types that we haven't been using. I said, great, you got it. And I let her, and I said, great, fine, it's your birthday. You can, here's the list of all the monsters in D&D, go ahead. And we sat down and I said, what did you bring? She says, mostly giants. I was like, oh, really? I didn't know that was a possibility. Do I have them on the list? And she says, yeah, go get all your giant miniatures, please, because I need them all. And I'm like, okay. She just pasted horribly. So anyway, so a little spoiler, if you haven't seen the war game yet, that's what happened. So she was really happy at the end of the night.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you again. We just saw it bump up again. Thanks, guys. Thanks so much.
That's
really fantastic.
Yeah. Great.
Looks like we got a donation from Yeffy's Backpack Express. Another Yeffy fan on the stream.
Awesome.
Thank you so much. That's great. So the funny news is because I was in a last minute scramble there to be prepared to have you just on the phone, because I assume in a fit of rage from having lost last night, you just ripped all your internet cables out. I did.
Pretty close.
I did collect a whole bunch of stills of Dan. I was like, oh, I better find a still of Dan. So now I have this lovely collection of stills of Dan, which I'll find an excuse to share at some point.
That covered is super valuable.
Never know when you might need that.
Well, the other thing is that I actually pitched an episode of just Giants today. Of like, we need to talk about Giants because something is not right with those things. So, but that's been tabled for a future episode. I will say, so, and other than that, like, it's going to be a lot of Giants this week on Wandering DMs because this is all brought Giants to the table. Saturday night, there's a little hint on the Tuesday game. There might be some Giants showing up.
Interesting.
So we'll probably I bet Paul, maybe you will feel like you need to talk about Giants next week, possibly.
Okay, yeah, maybe after we get past the Tuesday game I'll have a little more to say about it.
You'll have some more opinions about that.
Okay, but what are we talking about today, Dan? We're talking about economics.
Well, before we get into that, let me say one other thing. I do want to wish all our viewers a happy Tau Day, because it is Tau Day today. The proper circle constant. That is the number of radians that gets you all the way around a circle, not just halfway. So personally, I was also considering an episode in which we would specifically talk about things in D&D that are circular instead of only half circular. But I honestly couldn't come up with enough stuff. So maybe some other year.
But still, shields? Happy Tau Day. Shields.
Yeah, shields, wagon wheels. I don't know, certain Modrons. I'll keep the list is building, but no, we are not talking about that. We are talking about economic trading type stuff in D&D or role playing. So this came up for you recently, Paul.
Yeah. So I've been running in 10 Dead Rats. I've been running a lot of the classic content from the Warhammer campaign, The Enemy Within. My players are up to the section called Death on the Reich, in which it's presumed that the party has a boat. And they're moving around the Empire via river. And so the box set of Death on the Reich actually comes with an extra supplement, a little pamphlet, booklet thing that says, oh, if your party wants to, like, trade, here's some rules for trading. And they're a little quirky and a little difficult to get through, to be honest. And I had previously listened to, there's an actual play audio podcast recording of The Enemy Within, which I think is just called The Enemy Within. Which is really great. It's honestly what got me excited to run that content. And the DM of that wrote down his alternate rules for trading, and he used and he published. Well, he didn't publish those. He did publish those. You can get them. They're not publicly available for free. You have to like go and back him, donate to his. I don't know what it's old school. It's like just like a PayPal thing because it's from years before Patreon existed and whatnot. So but you send him a little money and he'll send you all his notes from running that campaign.
Great.
And so I had his notes and I was like, these are nice and concise and well written, and I'm going to try and use them. And it was a terrible failure at the table on the stream. And that's even the worst thing, right? Is like, never mind letting down my own players, but I've got an audience to deal with and I've got the tech to run and my brain is doing 16 different things. So having to also then like do tabular cross references and a bunch of math and deal with Warhammer's weird money system, which I personally love. Like, I hate the idea of ditching Warhammer's weird money system, but it just makes the math so much harder.
I saw you writing on your blog the other day about like what a perfect storm of too much stuff to handle that was. Just for those of us that aren't immediately familiar, what's the interesting weird thing about the Warhammer money system?
Well, it's based on the traditional English monetary system. You have gold crowns, silver shillings, and copper pence. And so it's 12 pence to the shilling and 20 shillings to the crown. So
anybody that's read my blog knows that I have a huge arsenal of stuff to say about that. I'll just go read my blog. Yeah, interesting.
Base 10 is so much easier to deal with, but I don't know, as an Anglophile and having dealt with actual English money in the past, it's just something that screams Warhammer to me. I've only ever seen it when playing Warhammer, and it just feels in fiction to me, so I don't want to get rid of it, because I like it. I like the feeling it adds.
I'm a big fan of bringing archaic units into your fantasy game, because it really slaps you in the face with an archaic, you know, milieu. So I'm a big fan of that.
But math with base 12 and base 20 is not easy. Right? Especially when you then have a table, so you've got a price of this this thing costs 3 gold crowns per crate, and you have 10 crates, but also because of the wealth of the town you're in, you get a 5% bonus, and because, you know, so that's the problem with this, with the tables that Tim wrote, is that they're all, there's a lot of different factors. Like, you get the base cost, and then you get an offset based on the supply-demand value of that town, and then you get another offset based on the wealth of that town. So it's just it's not hard math to do, but it's just a bunch of it, right?
Understood. I mean, at that point, I mean, you do need a calculator. I mean, at that point, you need a calculator, and it's like, is that what we want to be doing mid game? And maybe that actually, maybe that then detracts from the we're in a fantasy archaic world, but you have to grab a digital calculator for that.
And it changes the pacing, right? And this is one of the big differences I find between playing a game on stream versus playing a game in person. I was just actually saying this to my group last night. I sat down to play a private game. And I went, oh, this is so nice. This is so relaxed. I feel so, like, I don't have to worry about, you know, lags, right? If, oh, I need 5 minutes, hold on, everyone, while I do blah, I don't feel bad about that, right? Whereas on a stream, I feel this pressure to perform and to keep it going and keep the pacing going, which generally I want in my games. I want the pacing to be snappy. But generally, I'm okay with asking six people, hey, you know, give me 5 minutes, whereas, you know, asking a whole potential streamed audience, I feel, feels, I don't know, unprofessional.
You know, even, I mean, I might be repeating myself from last week, but I think we're being challenged just playing online. So, like, I have a game with your brother that that isn't being streamed, you know, publicly, but we play every other week online. And even that, we're finding to be, you know, more challenging. And it makes Max tired. It makes me tired. And so we've actually cut the sessions down from 4 hours just to 2 hours, because that's actually about how much endurance any of us have. Not even talking about the public streaming issue.
Yeah, you're talking about Zoom fatigue, right?
Yeah.
It's just a different way. Like, even just now, us communicating to each other, right? It requires a certain amount of focus because we know we have to take turns. We know that there's also maybe this half-second lag. So I have to, like, really sense where that gap is, where I can start talking. It's a little awkward.
That's a great, great point. It really adds additional mental burden. It sounds like so nothing-ish, and then it turns out to be such an amazing mental burden that you have to deal with. It makes a huge difference. I'm going to be back DMing our Tuesday just you and me game, and I've been thinking about, like, do I use the online dice roller, right? Just roll some dice, right? And normally I'm accustomed to just being instantaneous, and you can see it and I can see it, and we all know what happens. And with the, you know, the online thing, there's a lag. Does it show up? I don't know. You know, and that immediately changes the pacing in a way that I'm not super happy about. So I'm actually kind of wrestling with that at the moment.
It's really, really quite surprising just how long half a second actually is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it changes it enormously. And William says the same thing, and his games have been cut down. It's more of a hassle. I think we all agree. I think it's more of a hassle than we expected or wanted. It's kind of a drag. Yeah. So those of you who are running, you know, public streaming online games, that is really top level A+ master level, you know, D&D behavior. At one point I thought, man, I've got this. I've been doing this for so many years. I can do this. And man, you dive into the online thing. It's like, oh, geez, there is all kinds of static in the system to get your game across.
Yeah. It's tough. But on the other hand, it's a way for us to get together and socially interact, which there's not enough of right now.
Yeah.
Yep, so. Yep. Anyway, bit down a tangent there. The point being, what it comes to is how much bookkeeping, like we're just echoing the same conversation we had before about encumbrance. How much bookkeeping do you want at your table? And how much are you willing to let things at your table bog down with, oh, hang on, I got to do a whole bunch of math. And is that fun? Now, in our case, the interesting thing was I wasn't sure, right? I wasn't, there's a lot of things like this. We talked about this, I think, with puzzles, right? Where I have a puzzle that is a cipher where you have strange, you have a sort of Rosetta key handout, and you have a, this is in my published work, The Vile Crypt of the Reawakened Sisterhood. And even in that
presented by R.A. Salvatore.
Yes, R.A. Salvatore presents The Vile Crypt of the Reawakened Sisterhood, available now in the field. Yeah. And I even devote some text in there of like, some people are really going to like this and other players are not. And so you need to sort of have, you know, your ear to the ground here about, are your players going to find this fun or tedious? And if it's edging towards the tedious, remove it, right? Don't do it. You know, shortcut
it. You may not know that. You may not know that until you actually, you know, roll it out for your players. So you may possibly have a wrecked one wrecked session as you find that out. And I'll say that, you know, it's a thing that, you know, hasn't been super solid in original D&D. Like here's my, you know, original 74 D&D, you know, book. And in what's the DM's guide here, you've got the, you know, making baronies and then possible resources, right? Possible resources that you could have a resource, you know, game for. That's very short. That's all of two paragraphs, and that's all you get about running baronies. That's it. This space, there's some gold, and here's what you could possibly track. DMs, just go ahead and make that up. So there's been that, like a lot of like high level stuff in D&D, there's been that idea put forward of like, maybe you could do this, and there wasn't any really specific firm rules about it, you know, to be fine-tuned or to be evolved over the years. So we've always been going in a bunch of directions about possible rules that we could add on. Now, Dave Arneson in his first fantasy campaign has a somewhat more elaborate, somewhat larger elaboration of that list, but it's still not completely fine-tuned, nailed down. And as usual for Arneson, as you're saying, Paul, it's just insanely complicated, like insanely complicated. And it's really boggles my mind that he ever actually ran that. It looks like an aspiration, not something that was actually play tested.
It's so easy, right, to write these fairly complex systems into your game when you're sitting there alone in quiet reflection time at your computer or your typewriter, probably in his case, right? It's so easy to add those things and think it sounds like fun and not realize, you know, until you've brought it to the table, oh, wait a minute, this is disengaging, not engaging. Maybe, Dan, before we dig more in that direction, you can give us a little background, because this was, I think, a point we had, an exchange we had on my blog, where you were like, oh, that's kind of like this other experience that you had running a complex economic model in your D&D game.
Right. And so, you know, William just a second put up a post about, you know, domain management, and that's exactly what I was trying to do, is I was trying to expand on, you know, these OD&D rules. And so for a number of years at our annual convention, I was taking the classic D&D rules for Wilderness Adventures, which requires the outdoor survival board game, which is the original core D&D Wilderness. And that's where you get D&D Wilderness movement rates. And the whole idea of, you know, daily encounters comes right out of that Avalon Hill game. And so I was like, you know, with my standard house rules, I'm going to try to run this as close to the original book to find out what it is. And the first couple of years, people were in the wilderness, just going through a bunch of monster lairs, trying to get money, knocking over castles. And it was really kind of a hit, more than I expected. Multiple people asked me to redo it year after year. And it took about 3 or 4 years until people finally hit what I was calling the victory number, and you'd be declared barons. And then the at least at the end of that session, the players were really excited about, great, now we're barons. We set up a castle that we've confiscated, and we would like, and I think we ended 1 year saying we would like to set up a magic university and a church, and you know, get you know, build some roads and stuff like that. And so I came away from that going, okay, that's what this is transitioning into, and I'm going to have an annual, like, what's happened this year in your building, your budding kingdom. And so the last time we did that, you know, I brought some options. I made a half page list of options. What would you guys like to invest in this year? Magic weapons or more soldiers or build another castle or a road? And that actually turned into like one of the biggest disasters of my gaming experience. And I was really embarrassed about it because we had a 4-hour session. Those were usually large numbers of players. So at one year, we had as many as 14 people at the table in one of the sessions. And last time we did that, we sat down with 8 people, and there was just a huge difference of opinion in what they wanted to invest in. And my initial plan was this should take about 10 minutes. This should take about 10 minutes. You buy some stuff, you go on some adventures, and at the end, I tell you what has been built. And there was enough differences of opinions that it turned into a really ferocious, real argument between a number of the players, some of whom were really wanted to fine tune and optimize all those options and dig into it. And, you know, so there were maybe about 4 people that wanted to optimize it and had different opinions about how to optimize it. And they were arguing about that. And there were another 4 people, as I think is what's on your mind, Paul, who just weren't interested in the process whatsoever and just like, let's go kill some monsters and knock over some castles like we're yep. accustomed to. Yep. So there was a 2x2 matrix of dispute giving you about 4 different quadrants argumentation. Yeah. And I didn't do a good job of managing the table. And there were a couple of people actually came away with some hard feelings. About halfway through, I said, to hell with it. You know, I was seeing the people that weren't into it being really happy. And I said, to hell with it. You're going on adventure and monsters are attacking you. Kablam. Well, the 4 people that were into optimizing it were then mad at me for that. So that was actually one of the worst sessions I've ever had in an attempt to bring domain management to the table and not thinking ahead. I think the thing that we were similarly surprised about in these 2 sessions, the one that happened for you last week, was I just didn't realize how complicated it was going to be at the table. I thought this was going to be 10 minutes of decision making, and it could have gone on hours and hours and hours. In retrospect, now the thing, at least in that particular situation, is that it took me about a week to come up with this. Is I should have offloaded it. I should have made some kind of online website where people vote on their options and just get it done before the session starts.
So Ash makes a good point here that I want to throw up on the screen here, and he says, I feel like a lot of those domain managed systems end up falling into place where it's fun to do alone and torture to do with a group, right? And it's really, I mean, like, think about what you're doing essentially is you're modeling a system of government, right? You've modeled a system of government reasonably well, and then you've asked a group of people to run that government via committee. I think we all know how that's going to turn out, right?
It's 100%. I mean, that was going to be one of my big takeaways, and Ash totally nailed it there. It's surprising how long it's taken that point to dawn on me. You know, I see it in the books. I see it in the classic books. I see that being held out as an option. I bring it to my normal D&D table, and I don't think about that. But you're right. And I'll say that the times when those, like the stories that Gygax and Arneson have of times when that went well were when people were playing separate. You know, when like Arneson had one player that would just call him on the phone, like couldn't be there, would call him on the phone between sessions and say, I want my guy to do this, this, and this while he runs his castle. Right. Well, that's a great way to deliver an interesting experience when you're not with a group.
You know, I feel like that's always been the draw for it to me too. Like there's this romanticism around the reports from those old games where it sounds to me like that was the end game of D&D. You hit level 10 or so, you became a baron, you started getting into this domain management thing. You also then would have problems. Oh, there's, you know, some monsters out in the cornfields to the west. I need a party of adventurers to go take care of that. And then you would send that a different group of players or yourself playing a different character and other players off to go deal with that. And now, like, now you're generating the adventure as well as playing the adventure, right? It sounds super neat. But yeah, I think, you know, the problem with it, right, is that it's totally a thing that needs to be done on the side, right? Like, you want that verisimilitude of it feels like the world is alive, but you don't really want it at the table. You don't want to dredge through the details of it when you're at the table and it's game time.
Were you, Paul, were you part of, you know, we had these same debates at the company where you and I met. So were you part of the, so at one point at the Genetic Anomalies company that was bought by THQ, which is where Paul and I worked when we met, when I joined, there was plans to make a massively, you know, an MMO, a massively multiplayer online game at one point. We were having in-house conversations about wanting to do that. And I was coming to the table with that of like, well, you can have like fantasy adventurers. They're digging through dungeons. At some point, they get enough money. They build a castle and then they become the builders of dungeons in order to protect their stuff. And, that was many years ago. But the reasonable pushback I got was, well, that totally changes the game experience. And maybe not all players want to make that transition to become effectively DMs. Like I thought it would be great because then you graduate to the point where you're actually creating content, and that would be like a gathering snowball. But then the pushback is not everybody wants to do that.
I mean, I feel like it's not the answer here isn't get rid of it completely, right? This is like the answer that I came up with for my trade problem on the Reich thing is, first I started with just like, well, let me do out the math, right? I don't want to do the math at the table. Let me do it ahead of time, and I'll just make a whole bunch of handouts that have the math boiled down. And so I did that, and I made all these handouts of here's the price list of goods at Altdorf, and here's the price list of goods at Kemperbed, and here are all the different things. And now I can just throw those up on the screen and say, here you go. Here's how much stuff costs.
Yeah. Great. Yeah.
And when I presented that to my players, they were like, well, we don't want to do that. And I said, that makes, you know, I had that moment of like, well, of course you don't. That I wouldn't want to do that either as a player. I don't want to like sit there and be like, oh, I have 10 crates of corn and it sells at 3 gold a crate. Right. And then I can buy this. And blah, blah. I'm like, no, you don't want that. But you do want that high level of I'm schmoozing with the NPCs. I'm learning about the different trade routes and I'm making big high level decisions. And when I was building the handouts, I was thinking about the specific situation they were in. They're in Altdorf. They have 10 crates of coal. They know that they want to go to Kemperbed and eventually Nuln. So they know the route they want to take. And so the question is, what should we do? What should we trade for? And I'm looking at the numbers and I say, well, there's two choices, right? Either you sink all your money into one small luxury good that's very fragile. And you take a big risk and see if you can make it all the way, or you buy a slightly less valuable good in more quantity that you're going to have to trade at the next town and then trade at the next town and keep doing these up trades all along the route. And I'm like, that's an interesting choice to make. It's an interesting choice to make, and it affects the game because are we carrying a small amount of a luxury good or a large amount of a bulk good? Maybe that has impact based on what we encounter on the river, right? If we encounter, you know, tax collectors, or we encounter pirates, or you know, any number of things you might encounter on the river, it's interesting to know what's in the hold.
Agreed.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's an interesting experience because it says that if you are doing this for a group, then you can just have just two options, maybe, you know, two or three options may be enough. You don't need to make an entire worldwide economic system, which and for many of us, that's somewhere between like we're interested in that research or we personally quickly really want to actually understand it ourselves. So it's a really easy pipe that me and many other people and many friends go into of like really wanting to understand all of it, when you know just two or three options is a perfectly fine game experience for a team in particular.
I would say, though, it's really hard to make a believable two or three options without having done the research, right? Like, I needed to have done all the math and looked at all the charts to be then able to say, okay, here are the two options. And then it was very easy to say, here are the two options, because I can just look at the sheets and, oh, it makes sense to me. So I think it was still worth the effort. And I would, and I'm going to continue to do it, honestly. But it's now a thing that I'm going to do alone in between sessions so that when I come to the session, I can say, okay, here are the options.
That is a great point. And, you know, in original D&D, they didn't distinguish that, right? They didn't they weren't careful about distinguishing what part is background research versus what part gets put to the players. So it's not something that tends to be on my mind enough. You know, I guess, it's passingly similar to the fact that when third edition D&D came out, you know, they had this whole skill system that was very complicated, had many, many details to it. And like when I first glanced at it, I was like, wow, a lot of thought has been put into this. There's a lot of consistencies here, this looks great. And then at a table, it's too complicated to use, in my opinion. And the funny thing is I keep the third edition player's handbook near my desk so that if I am making some kind of encounter in original D&D, I tend to pull that out, look at their statistics for skills, and then convert it to something simpler, like on a D6 or something like that. So having a complicated, consistent, well thought out system behind the scenes, and then you present something a lot simpler is actually something I do quite a lot for that.
Yeah. It's the analogy I made on my blog is it reminds me of when I was in college studying creative writing. I had an instructor who said, who would sometimes say of writing that you presented, this chunk here, this first chapter, this first section, this first page, this is scaffolding. You need to get rid of it, right? It was important for you to write it so that you understood it, so you could get to the good writing. But right. Now you got to the good writing. This is not doing anything for you. Get rid of it.
Right. I'd be interested in, like, I hear that, and then I also hear successful writers. I think R.A. Salvatore, didn't he say, oh, I'm just totally, by the seat of my pants, I don't know what's happening on the next page.
Mm-hmm.
So at least there's a difference of opinion about that, I guess.
Well, if any
of our viewers like want to comment what their writing practice is, I guess I'd kind of appreciate seeing that, actually.
I don't want to put words into Bob's mouth, but I suspect he would then say, well, of course he edits, right? Like, of course he goes back and looks at what he's written and decides what stays and what goes. Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah. I don't know. The scaffolding notion, it almost always came up as the beginning, right? You would hand in like 10 pages of writing and she'd say like this first page, right? The first, like, you know, you needed to get this information out onto the page so that it was in your head so that then you could write the stuff, but it's actually not helping the story as a whole when you present it to another person.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I will say in my game writing, like, it's not totally, I haven't published this quite as much as I want to, but like I've gotten in the habit of writing more and more footnotes, or technically endnotes. It's like, so I make game rules. So the current game rules I've been writing the last year or two is like short, here's the game. And then the endnotes are actually much longer than the actual game, of explaining where it came from or what reference I'm looking at or why I decided on this or some real world research and stuff like that. So I've gone in a zone where my game rules are actually just the tip of the iceberg, and then it's actually the footnotes that's actually the whole rest of the work.
I mean, that's interesting, but would you argue that that people should be reading those footnotes, or that it is an optional thing?
Optional, probably. More likely for DMs. Players, no. DMs, probably so. Is I think where my
I've definitely
mind's
seen
at
that on. Like in your OED publications, and I will admit I haven't read the footnotes. I know they're there. I appreciate that they're there, and I trust that you did good homework, and that I can just glean the cream off the top and just use that. And go, great. Well, Dan did his research.
In the players' rules, it's specifically set up so the OED players' rules are four panels. So it actually, at some point, I'll say the footnotes actually say, don't print this part out. Just print out the first four pages because it fits on one sheet, right? If you want to hand out paper, just do that part. Don't print out the footnotes because you don't need that. So that's, I would say players, I don't expect at all to read that stuff, but occasional DMs who want to check my work, I encourage that. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Great. Yeah, I mean, it is nice to have a format like that, I think, where you've drawn a line in the sand where you can say, you know, if you care, you can dig in. But if you don't need to, you don't need to. It's nice. Yeah. It's good. I
do want the game rules as quick and as curt as possible. But back to trading. So I do want to elaborate a little bit more on Ash's point about that, that I think we agree with, that the trading economic stuff really might be better for just one person at a time. And the trap that I keep stepping into is go, here's the trading stuff. Here's my D&D game. Trading goes into the D&D game. Oh, it's a whole bunch of people now. It's a problem. And it also, you start doing domain management. And of course, Frank Metzer elaborated on that in his Beckme rules. And they had a whole adventure series, like the whole companion module adventure series is specifically to dig into, we're running domains now in a particular, you know, new fantasy realm. And the part of the problem is you make that transition and you're accustomed to having this Lord of the Rings type, you know, fellowship of, you know, a team. And then you're running a kingdom. And of course, the traditional, you know, real world trope is there's one master tyrant.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. There's one in charge and what they say goes and the end. So when you make that transition in D&D and you try to keep the team structure, like I always feel uncomfortable or that I'm ignoring the obvious difficulties of like, oh, now we have a democratic oligarchy, but they're not elected. That's pretty right. much never right. happened in the world. Like people expect a king, and I'm always dancing around the slight cartoonishness of ignoring the difficulty at that point. Same point for ships, right? I kind of want like mid-level characters to start dealing with ships, as you've seen. But again, the thing on a ship or even a modern ship or a modern plane, the pilot has complete dominant authority while you're en route. And, you know, so I throw out a boat in, you know, a D&D game and now, oh, we're going to have a mutual conversation about like what's, and maybe have a vote. And that clearly violates the normal functioning on a ship where someone makes a choice. So maybe that stuff should be offline and should be made like one-on-one game instead.
I mean, it's interesting to think of sort of like the literary or cinematic representations of this and imagine, would that be fun to play, right? So I'm thinking of like Lord of the Rings, right? You I just rewatched those movies recently, right? So the party comes in and they treat with Theoden and he's got to make a call of X or Y, right? That's interesting and dramatic, and but ultimately, you know, King Theoden's got to make the call, and then we're angry about what he chose, but some people think it's right, and you know, that's drama and interesting. And then I think of like, but if we get into that mode where, we're a kind of a democratic party, and now we're going to collectively control this ship or control this realm, and like, I'm like, well, what fiction is that like? And the only thing coming to my brain is like episodes of Parks and Rec, right? Right? You're like, great, we're gonna form a committee and we're gonna hold a meeting and like, this fun? Is this?
That's kind of what happened in my last Outdoor Spoliation game. It was a kind of angry season one Parks and Rec sort of.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you could make fun of that and you could enjoy it if you set out in the right direction. But I don't know. I think I'm very interested in the notion of sort of bringing it offline. And I like your idea of possibly even like engaging with more than one player by setting it up in some kind of website or some kind of whatever it is, some asynchronous method where you've got your spreadsheets or your documents or whatever, and you're just pinging people and saying, okay, well, you guys got to just choose X or Y or, you know, tell me what you want to do. And then letting that inform the in-person session where we're actually playing. Okay, we have a thing, we have a quest, let's go do it.
Right. And the other thing, I mean, you know, now we're all distant and, you know, and as life goes on, like friends move away and stuff like that. And, you know, also thinking about Arneson's phone-in player, is this would possibly be a way to involve like one person who's moved away or is distant to still be involved in your campaign by setting them up as running some lordship or the king, and you can get input from them. Like, actually, so I did that actually with disinvited guest Isabel Garbani. And it never came up, and I felt bad because I sat down before that outdoor spoliation game and I said, hey, you're running. You have 20 minutes. You're running one of the opposing kingdoms, and you have these resources, which are exotic and different. Tell me what you would do. And she's like, oh, I want A, I want B, I want C. And I was like, I would never have thought of any of that stuff. That is wonderful, right? Yeah. Wonderful. I don't think the players knew, but at some point spies came in to their barony, right? Came through and interacted with them. And they didn't realize that it was Isabel that had sent the spies.
That's right. Great.
And it didn't pay, you know, we got sidetracked, and then I had to come back and apologize to Isabel because, you know, her stuff didn't really get used the way that I should have. But I think I'm starting to take baby steps. I've wanted for for many years in the back of my mind, I've wanted like a war game situation where I had distance players running the kingdoms, and then I had local players dealing with the party, you know, running around and dealing with the chaos or the mayhem. Yeah. And I haven't, you know, and you know, one of the people, you know, and among the people that I would want to do that would be you, of course, and our friend who passed away at the start of the year, BJ, unfortunately. So at this, there's a, anytime I think about that now, I'm a little bit heartbroken because I really wanted BJ to be one of the people, one of the ferocious leaders running, you know, one of the, and I wouldn't tell the players that was what happening, but have him behind the scenes running some stuff. Yeah.
We've toyed with this idea in the past, right? Like we've talked about when we talk about like co-DMing games, right? This notion of like, well, what if you had a campaign that had an evil villain and who's you know, removed, right? Who's just pulling a puppet master, right? And then actually get some external person to play the puppet master, right? So you're doing like asynchronous email or something with that person and saying, okay, here's what's going on. And they give instructions and then you implement it in the game. I think that would actually be super, super fun. And I think, now that I think about it, we've kind of touched at it a little bit, if you recall. I think we had, I was running a D&D campaign and the players were invested in this town that was about to get assaulted by undead, and I had you come in and we did a mass battle to represent the invasion of Bridgefair, and you came in and played the general, and I'm like, all right, for this session of the game, we're actually going to play a war game, and I have special guest Dan Collins coming in to be the war master of the evil army.
Undead army. Yeah.
It was really fun. Was it was fun for me as fun. DM to have that kind of random input of like, I'm going to set up the pieces. Here are the pieces in play. The players have done this and they've built up these defenses. And then Dan's going to come in and do, I don't know what. Here's your army. Good luck. And we're going to see what happens.
Put up William's comment. Put up the comment that William just posted there because I love that to death.
So I did that with the player's 6-year-old daughter who sat in at our table one night. They are vicious.
That's what the game should be. The game should be all that. The game should just be all that. This six-year-old kids playing for the first time, and they're gonna be absolutely out for blood. That's fantastic. I love that.
That is hilarious. That is hilarious.
Yeah. That's a nice. And I mean, and then that came back around, obviously, to, you know, me playing the adversary in, you know, games that we do. So that's
It's interesting. So the other thing that I think of that this always reminds me of, and that I have this fantasy of a game in my head that doesn't actually exist, and I don't know if it could exist, but there was a series of novels from I think back in the 80s called Game Earth. Have you ever heard of that, Dylan Dan?
No.
I can't even remember who the author was, but it was playing on the trope of, you know, the you got players who are playing a role-playing game or something that sounds like a role-playing game, and but actually it's real, right? Actually it's real, and so the novel is jumping back and forth between the perspective of the players and the perspective of the characters in the world who are dealing with the impact of what's going on. And of course, then something weird happens where there's actual transfer of people between settings. But the thing that reminds the weird thing about it is you read this book and you realize, like, this is probably a person. They were either playing a really custom game that never got published, or they weren't playing anything, that they like heard about D&D secondhand, did some research, and then wrote this book. Because I don't know what game it is they're playing. It sounds awesome. Basically, you've got four players sitting around a big wilderness board. Each one controls a quadrant. So each one is like the ruler of this quadrant. But also they're role-playing characters in an adventuring band. And so when the adventuring band goes into someone's quadrant, then that player sort of steps back and takes on the sort of mastermind DM role, and this sort of this hybrid, like, I'm the DM, but also I'm the person in control of this region, and everyone else is playing the characters. And then just by like physically moving from one location to another, that role shifts.
Interesting.
That sounds super fun. I don't know if it would work, But it sounds fun.
Yeah, you know, there was the, you know, there was an online cartoon for a number of years that was, you know, was initially hosted on Order of the Stick called Earthworld, right? Where the and the tone was maybe a little more comic, a little bit more broad satire than I really wanted, but the theme was that there's a fantasy world with armies. If someone cast a magic spell to get the best possible warlord, well, that was a person in the real world who played the game and knew the rules and gets ganked into the fantasy world. And the fact that they actually know all the rules and they run the battles by intentionally metagaming, right? It's like, I know that three things here and a stack and a bonus and da-da-da-da, which I thought was an interesting take. And there's also a current comic book by the author Kieran Gillen, who I think is just really just crushing it. Kieran Gillen just makes amazing work these days. And he's got a current comic series which explicitly references Dungeons and Dragons by name, in which a bunch of people get yanked into a fantasy world as kids, get sent back, and then 40 years later as adults get yanked back in again. And have their normal lives disrupted as a result. And that comic book goes by the name of Die, which is a pretty clever name for a fantasy story like that. Actually, I really love the title. It's simply called Die.
That's good.
So those are good.
It's a popular trope, right? I think immediately of Robert Bevin's Critical Failures books, which are much more humor. But again, it's similar trope of like they get sucked into the world, but they know the rules of the game they're playing and they start using that to their advantage. You know, but mostly to make dick jokes in Robert Bevin's case.
Or Narnia.
It's a great trope.
Or Narnia.
Narnia. Yeah.
And then that's what I was thinking about with Kieran Gillen's, like, and then they get yanked back in later, because I always frankly got hurt. I've maintained this permanent hurt over the kids getting booted out of Narnia when they age out. And that hurt has never gone away for me. So the fact that Gillen was like, what if at a really bad time they get yanked back in, it really caught my attention. Now, the other thing I had here that I prepped here was I do have, here's my my D&D campaign rules binder, and I do have an article on Sea Trade. This might be from like Dragon number, I don't know, it's an early Dragon, like number 10 or 12. So I had this ready in case it comes up. It never came up actually. Now, I think with your experience this week, Paul, I think I'm glad it didn't, because I think I would have had the same problems. I would have run smack into this and had major problems. On the other hand, so I haven't used that. On the other hand, what I have personally done is in the TSR science fiction game Star Frontiers, their second box set, which provides spaceships and traveling around the galaxy and stuff like that, has, what is this, four pages here on trading. So I have it on my tablet here. So there's this. And then you can get into passenger services, where you're actually carting around passengers. And then you can get into commercial trade and mining and things like that. And you can see here, like, maybe you can't see here, but the point of this table is, you see on the, there's two columns, right? There's two columns here. And all there is price at the source and price at the destination. That's it. So there's no percentages. It's just like, here's what you buy it at, and then here's what you sell it at, and it's just fixed. So fairly simple. I actually did use that pretty successfully in a game that I was running for one person. And they were actually traveling around the Star Frontiers galaxy, and they were buying and they were selling and they were trading, and they were pretty happy with that. And for the one person that I was running that in high school for a while from one of my cousins, we actually did have a good time with that. Yep. So that...
I'm hoping the river trade in 10 Dead Rats is going to go in a good direction, because I think it's interesting, because it sets up, it goes from a lot of the original source of saying, like, these towns produce these goods, right? And once you start with that, you can sort of start to say, like, well, there's different trade routes, and obviously, like, there's right choices, right? Like, over here, you probably want to buy wool from Bogenhofen, and then you want to bring it up to Altdorf, because Altdorf needs wool, and they don't make it, right? So that's nice, right? And you get that sort of, like, the price changes based on where you're bringing a thing. But really, what it boils down to, right, is that we have this character Yeffie, who is pretty nefarious, pretty connected to the underground, and like clearly wants to kind of like see, can I use this to become Han Solo, and start, you know, start, you know, some kind of smuggling operation, which would be fantastic and fun, and again, probably lead to some very fun encounters. But I need the underlying knowledge. I need to know what the trade routes are, and I need to know what you know, goods are valuable in different locations. And then I also need to know, like, what are the laws that are going to get in the way? And then what law, how can she cleverly break those laws to her advantage?
As a suggestion, like, just having looked at the Star Frontiers thing there, like, just as a starting point, I think they just categorize every single star system in one of three categories of, is it agricultural, is it industrial, is it commercial? Kind of a little bit like the three categories of like SimCity zoning, right? Mm-hmm. So like as at least as a starting point, they go, well, here's this stuff you can buy in a commercial zone. This stuff is what's produced in an industrial zone. This stuff is produced in an agricultural zone instead of like, I don't know. If someone does have the time and energy and interest to specify every single town, every single region, do that. But maybe just for starters, you could just specify like three different categories of stuff. And maybe that would be a good start.
Yeah, I could see that.
I've also been pointing out that Stars Without Number, which I've also heard good things about, actually. I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it either. Okay, so, yeah, none of us have tried it. Okay, but we'll have to check it out. I don't know. I think for me, like the one thing you don't want is something that just feels fake, right? If you just had like that chart you're talking about that just says, here's what you buy it at, here's what you sell it at, that makes me nervous because then it sets us up for very unrealistic loops where I'm like buying and moving in a triangle and I'm constantly making a profit moving things. And I'm like, what, last week I bought, you know, wool from you and now I'm selling it back to you at a profit? Doesn't make sense, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, assuming that agricultural areas produce wool and never buy it,
you want that factor to say like this, these goods are tied to these locations, right? That they're cheap here and they're expensive there. I think that's an important piece of it.
I agree.
Yeah, but I think you know whatever you got to do. Ultimately, my goal would be to try and make sure you do your homework. Right. Ultimately, that's my advice here. Do your homework.
Yeah.
Know the numbers so that you don't have to spend game time pawing through books and looking up tables and doing math. And you can just say, well, you know, the only paper mills are in Altdorf and they need paper in Nuln, so you should buy paper.
Right. How are you going to handle, you know, the Yeffie character being the one who's interested in that? Are you going to do any offline stuff, or are you going to bring that to the table in game?
I'll bring it to the table, but so the good news is they have an NPC who came with them who knows the trade routes, so that NPC can be my mouthpiece. And the party's already set that up. They've already just started turning to that NPC and saying like, well, what do you think, what should we do, can you just take care of this?
Right
So now I can just use that NPC as the mouthpiece. And I imagine that there will be some fun conversations between that character and Yeffie as she sort of like feels out the like, oh, tell me about the taxes on brandy. Interesting.
Right.
I wonder how I could package brandy. It's like, well, right. Like, I think that's going to happen. You know, and then, you know, then there'll be just be interesting moments of when that comes to light, or it doesn't. And she just makes a profit and she feels good that her character's clever.
Great. Very good.
Yeah.
I will look forward to that on 10 Dead Rats on Thursdays at 8.
Yes. So actually, we're we actually just finished our season finale, so we will not be on this Thursday. Okay. A week from Thursday, we'll be beginning season two, and there will be some exciting stuff. I'm sure River Trade will come up because it is definitely, you know, the party is on a boat, they're moving around the rivers. Why would you not load up your hold
with
some kind of tradable good? Like, why wouldn't you? Of course you would. Yeah.
Right.
I think it's probably, you know, a big part of this though is sort of knowing what's fun for you, what's fun for your group, you know, and being able to draw that line and say like, you know what, if my group doesn't want to engage in this and I don't want to do all the extra work behind the scenes, great. Definitely hand wave it, right? Like, just say, okay, whatever. You can spend X gold on goods, trade goods. We're not even going to worry about what they are, and you'll gain 10% profit at this next town. Done.
Yeah.
You could totally do that. Just be upfront, I think, with your players about like, oh, I'm just going to hand wave this because nobody wants to engage with it. It's fine.
Mm-hmm. And the idea of having an NPC be the interface point is a good one. That's very smart.
It helps have a reason to spit out information at the players.
I gotta say, there's possibly a large. So before we wrap up, I gotta say, this is possibly part of a larger conversation about mini games. Is what was on my mind when I was preparing for this morning. Is that there's a lot of things in classic D&D of have games inside your games, and among the things that are on my mind are the chainmail jousting system. So in original D&D, it says you get in a joust, go dig up chainmail and go run a joust mat, or you want wilderness adventures, go get outdoor survival, or here's a mini game for ship combat, here's a mini game for air combat, you're playing Star Frontiers first module, all of a sudden there's a mini game for alien soccer ball, some kind of alien, Pele, whatever it is, right, that you've never seen before.
I mean, every prop-based puzzle you hand to your players is itself a minigame, right?
Perfect. And so, some of that, and I personally read that, and I like recursion, frankly. it intrigues me. So having a game that has a game inside it, intrigues me as a reader and a thinker about games. And, I'm always excited by that. And I think in my experience in the last couple of years, there's at least a peril, at the very least, there's a peril that your players are not going to want to learn a whole bunch of new rules on the fly, or are going to be at a major disadvantage because I, the DM, have been thinking about this for years. They've never seen it. And obviously, when I was running chainmail jousting, I cleaned everybody's clock every single time it ever happened, to the point where my players, I don't know if you were a part of that, Paul, but at some point I heard somebody say, the next person who challenges us for a joust, just kill that asshole.
Kill him, yeah. I mean, we kind of hit that problem.
Challenges for a joust. And
We hit that problem, too, when you came and guested as the evil warlord to play Book of War, and it was pointed out, oh, great, you invited the guy who wrote the game to come play the enemy. Guess who's going to win?
That's a good game. It's either me or a six-year-old girl. It's one of the two. There's your options. I'm happy with either one of those. Yeah. Yeah, so we'll talk more about that at some point, because we've gone back and forth about that, and I've actually taken some stuff out in order to use like a more of a core rule type thing.
Great. Well, let me put a specific call out here to our viewers and our listeners. Yeah, if you have any specific examples you can give us of mini games that have appeared in your campaign, please get in touch with us. Leave us a comment in the video. We're going to collect some of that information. Definitely seems like a great topic for a future talk. Yeah. Let us know so we can incorporate that. We appreciate it.
And tell us that, we have a Tuesday solo game between just me and Paul. So tell us if you'd like to see at some point us running a domain or ship or trading exercise with one-on-one. See how that goes, perhaps. Maybe that's something we should do at some point, Paul.
Yeah, for sure. Great.
Or you think about which one of those things you'd prefer to play in, perhaps.
Yeah, I'll give that some thought. All right, well, that's awesome. About our time. Thank you so much for joining us today in this conversation. Again, if you have thoughts, comments about any of these topics and more, please leave us some comments below. We'd be delighted to read them and get back to you with our thoughts.
Definitely. Great conversation today. I'm so glad you had that experience this week, Paul, actually. I think that will benefit me and a lot of other people actually here. So really great conversation today. Now, if anybody's new, remember that you can like and follow and subscribe to us on various social media like Facebook and YouTube and Twitch and Twitter, where we have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites.
You can also listen to our show in audio-only podcast format. You can find that at our website at www.wanderingdms.com or a variety of podcast carriers such as Google Podcasts, iTunes, etc. If you are listening to us from one of those carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us there. We really appreciate that.
We definitely do. Thanks again for those of you who are patrons of the show and support us doing this. We totally couldn't do this if you weren't here engaging in the conversation and helping us out resource-wise as well. If you would like to join our very generous patrons, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll see how to do that. Several different tiers there of support. We currently do have, this week we're going to have, I think, three shows. So we're going to have the Tuesday solo game show where I'm going to start running a classic Marvel superheroes face rip game from the 1980s. Paul, have you played that in the past before?
Didn't we play that together at a convention not too long ago?
That was like a different okay. Retro clone that was quite different. So great. So you're going to see this.
I love the system, and I have fresh eyes on this. Yep.
I love being able to share the system with other people, actually, because I actually, it's pretty clever, actually. So that's happening Tuesday. And then, actually, I guess that's it, actually, now that I think about it, because you're off on Thursday, and then we're off on Saturday for because we're playtesting our other project, actually. But we will be back next Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time for a more thought-provoking discussion. We hope that you'll join us.
We'll see you then.